Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour of the show, we're doing this program that we have done for a while now, every other month. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. We have a number of physicians who specialize in different things, and occasionally they're here and they talk about their particular area. But we also, a long time ago, thought, well, it would be good to have somebody who was a generalist, who saw a lot of different people, who had different sorts of health concerns, to just make it wide open and to say, okay, here we have a guy, he sees people, he sees grown-ups, he sees children, he sees people who have a variety of issues, and say, whatever is on your mind, whatever health question you have, call in and talk with the doctor, given that, of course, we can't diagnose over the phone, but he's dispensed a lot of good information over the years. He being Dr. Jeff Swearingen, family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana. So we're set up here to take your calls, and he and I can talk, and we'll fill up the time, but the important thing is, he's here as a resource for you. So if you have some kind of health question, you know, whatever you would think of asking a doctor, call in, ask him. He will give you the best answer he can. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we also have email. If you'd like to send your question that way, you certainly may. Will-talk, so W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Thank you very much for being here once again.
David, once again, my pleasure.
You know, fairly recently, and maybe not so recently here, I think within the healthcare community and people who look at human health, there has been a lot of discussion about what kinds of periodic screenings should be done in terms of things like, you know, cholesterol, mammogram, pap smear, prostate, you know, what have you, things, you know, who should be checked and how often. And maybe we talk about that, but actually in and among all of this, I've seen some articles questioning the idea of the annual physical and asking this question, well, really, who, if anybody, needs to have this visit with a physician every year? And I wonder what you think about that. Is there still a place for the annual physical?
I think there's a place for a physician and the patient to sit down and talk about what things should I be aware of, what things do I need to be checked for, what am I at risk for, what should I be doing. Does that mean a comprehensive physical every year? No. But too often the visit to the physician is focused on a particular complaint. And so the patient comes in and says, this bothers me. And all of the time is then spent sort of figuring out what that might be, how we might investigate it further, how we might treat that, and no additional time is spent on, gee, everybody in your family died of heart disease before 50. Maybe we should check your cholesterol. Because unless somebody brings it up, it just doesn't get thought of. One of the things that I try to impress upon our residents in our training program is to try and take a step back from whatever it is that the patient came in for and say, what is the totality of this person's healthcare condition and what are the things that we should, not necessarily today, but at some point, address? And it goes back to that person who has the family history of heart disease. What are their underlying risk factors? What should be done about that? The woman who has a strong family history of breast cancer. Again, what should be done about that with that information? But does everybody need an annual physical every year? Absolutely not. Okay. You know, if you are 25 years old, have had your immunizations updated appropriately, aren't on any medications, do you need a physical? No. Okay. What you need is somebody to remind you to buckle up your seatbelt. Your biggest risk of death in that age group is motor vehicle accidents. You can reduce your risk of death by simply buckling up your seatbelt. You can reduce it by 50%, as a matter of fact. And that's a tremendous improvement. That's better than most of the things that we do with medication. We don't get a 50% reduction in death rates with most of the things we prescribe. But just simple things like that. Immunizations are one of the things that are thought of during regular annual physical exams. Screening tests, there are, in fact, certain things recommended for certain people at certain ages. And again, the, quote, physical or whatever preventive health visit you want to call it, is a good time to review those things. And but does it need to be done every year? Generally not.
What about it? What about as people get older? Let us say you have a patient who is over 50 or over 60 or over 70. Does that change the answer?
Most of the time, those folks have some other chronic medical condition for which they're going to be seen periodically anyway. And I don't think it's unreasonable to designate one visit a year as one where we take the extra time not only to address that medical condition, but review your immunizations, your screening tests. Is there something new in your family history that we need to know about? So I think, but again, does everybody need a comprehensive head-to-toe physical every year? No.
We have a question. Someone here is calling in. We'll be very happy to take this and others. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's our first caller, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The host and the doctor, good morning to you. I actually had maybe a point or a question that I think is important, and it goes along with what you're talking about, is I think the best thing a doctor can have is good communication and good bedside manners. I've known of surgeons that are supposed to be terrific, but they don't know how to talk to a layman. Or, you know, you're treated just like a car in the shop or something. And then there's other doctors that can actually speak to you despite whatever your personality is. I actually debated going in the medical field, and after my experiences in the military, I realized that I could not hold any. I would judge people just by when I walked in the room, and I couldn't just walk in and be neutral with everybody. So I knew that that wouldn't be fair for me to go in the medical field. And, you know, how do doctors get around that and communicate with a person rather than just judging a person by their looks or the surroundings or such and such and actually get to the real problem and listen to the patient and talk to them? I think that's one of the key things, and you're touching on that. I think that's one of the key things with a doctor. You got to be able to speak professionally to your staff and such and other doctors, but you also have to have the talent to speak to a layman to let them know what is actually going on and on their level and just be friendly about it or whatever, because after all, you're treating the whole patient, not just a particular thing. And that's all I had. And sounds like you're already touching on that, but I just want to say that's one thing I've heard complaints about from a lot of other people with doctors is they feel like they're, basically put down or whatever, or talked down to and or ignored. And I hear about the good doctors, and they're the friendly ones. They're the ones that talk and communicate and so forth. That's the only comment I really had, comment, question, whatever you want to call it. I think it's something very important for a doctor to consider.
And I agree wholeheartedly with you, and I would just point out that the original term doctor comes from the Greek and means teacher. And to a large extent, at least in primary care, that's what we do. We try to educate our patients as to what some of the medical and health consequences of what they're doing might ultimately be. We start with the assumption that people sort of want to be healthy and basically help them sort through all of the various medical issues and diagnostic choices and the treatment options that are available. And in the long run, we hope that they make good choices for themselves and that their health will benefit in the long run. But a large part of that is simply communicating that information. And part of it is listening carefully to find out, you know, what their concerns are and helping them identify what their medical issues are.
So
I would like to add the majority of doctors that I have seen, I understand where they're coming from. And I also want to add, for anybody that's just a patient or whatever, we have to remember that medicine is still a practice. Every different human body is different. You may give me a pill for one condition and somebody else with the same condition, you give them a pill, and one of us has a bad reaction and one of us doesn't, because it's still a practice. And I want to remind folks out there that it's practicing medicine, or it still is. And that's an important point that patients need to realize, that every human body is different from the other, and it's just a guesstimate based on, you know, an educated guess, basically.
You're correct.
When doctors are working. So I'll shut up now.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call. No,
Thank you.
Right from the beginning, I figured, of course, that you would agree with what the mm-hmm. caller had to say. And you work with students. Is this something that you can teach?
Some folks come by it more naturally than others. But yes, it is a teachable skill, and one that is still extremely important. There are some estimates that in terms of making a diagnosis, 80% of the information that you need is actually obtainable in the patient's history. So you have to listen carefully, ask the appropriate questions, and follow up on them. Mm-hmm. But what should be happening is then the additional 20% of information is either obtained by the physical exam, which should hopefully help confirm what it is that you're thinking after listening to the history, and then perhaps some laboratory testing. It should be confirmatory, not I don't have a clue as to what's going on, so I'm going to order a whole bunch of different tests. But what has happened more commonly with American medicine is that in an effort to get through patients faster, you listen less and order more tests. And it's gotten to the point now where patients sort of expect that. If somebody listens carefully and says, this is what I think is going on, and the patients frequently say, but don't I need a CT, MRI, blood, it's become such an inculcated part of the way practice is done that it's almost expected now. That generates, one, a lot of expense, and two, not uncommonly, then odd little results that you then have to do additional testing to follow up on that probably had nothing to do with the original problem. So if physicians would take the time to listen, we would probably do a whole lot less testing. And I don't think, in fact, anybody's health would suffer for that. There are now starting to be studies that estimate that probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 5% of all the cancers in the United States may be related to radiation exposure, which was medical in origin. Basically, too many CT scans mm-hmm. in the same patient over and over again. So we're now getting to the point where excess testing is actually causing some additional problems, and that's taking it too far.
Okay. We have several callers here. We'll get to them and take them in the order that they came in. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. Every other month he's here for this show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor, and we have several folks who would like to talk with him. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go next to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign.
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Yes, I have two questions, and they both have to do with immunizations. I'm 87 years old, and I have children in their 50s and 60s, and, of course, grandchildren who are 20-ish to 30-ish. And I'm aware that there is a whooping cough pertussis epidemic, apparently, in the Northwest. We're having a family wedding out there in July, and I'm wondering, do we all need to get booster shots before we go?
Very good question. You are correct. Pertussis, which is the old whooping cough.
Yeah, I had it when I was four.
Right.
Believe me, I don't want to wish it on anybody else.
And it is, in fact, making a comeback in the adult population because it turns out that the DPT that you got as a kid, the immunization, the P was the pertussis part, basically wears off eventually as an adult. So there's currently a standard recommendation for all adults at some point when they're getting their regular tetanus booster, which is done every 10 years, that one of those immunizations should include the pertussis. So consistently what we've been doing, you know, for the last, I would say, 10 years or so is when people are due for their regular tetanus booster, we simply combine the pertussis and their tetanus at the same time. It can be given as a single shot. But yes, adults should, in fact, be getting an immunization for pertussis.
Okay, good. The other question is about shingles. I have several good friends who have had nasty cases of shingles in the fairly recent years. And when my Carl doctor told me that there was a vaccine, I said, I want it. But several of them have, several of my friends have said that they were sort of discouraged by the side effects of the vaccine, that so that they have not had it, and now they've had the disease. Is that a major problem?
I personally have not seen any major problems in people who have received the shingles vaccine. And certainly any side effects related to the vaccine pale in comparison to actually having shingles.
Absolutely.
Which is absolutely a miserable event to undergo. The shingles, for some of the folks listening, is simply the reactivation of the chickenpox virus in your system. When you had chickenpox as a child, you broke out all over, and then it eventually went away. But the virus continues to live in some of our nerve endings. And later in life, typically after 60, when immunity can start to decline, that virus can reactivate and break out along typically a nerve root. So you get a band-like pattern of blistering kinds of very painful skin lesions. And this can significantly be reduced in likelihood by immunizing people then after the age of 60 again to basically give them a booster on their immunity against the chickenpox virus.
Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. And we'll continue. The next caller is in Urbana and line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
As we get older, our memory is less good. I have found that when doctors send a written report, you know, a narrative, like in paragraphs, the few times that that's happened, I have found it so very helpful because I can't remember everything the doctor said. And I go over them again and again, and it's really helpful. However, I have asked recently, I've just asked, almost pleaded for such a report. And if I get anything at all, it's technical medical terms, abbreviations. The last one I got was four pages of numbers and letters, which meant absolutely nothing to me. What do I need to do to get a copy. I think it's just a copy of the doctor's notes. I think they write a summary, don't they? And why can't I get a copy of it?
Well, I was going to say, in most offices, the usual routine is to either write, though this day and age it's typically dictate or put directly into a computer system, a summary note of each visit, and if you're going in for a comprehensive visit at, you know, once a year or however often it's deemed necessary, there should be a complete summary of your medical condition. And while there may be some few technical terms in there, or the vast majority of dictations should be, you know, understandable by the patient, and there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be able to get a copy of that.
How do I go, other than I begged and pleaded and talked to every staff person I saw and the doctor, and they said, okay, fine, we'll do that. I just don't get them.
The way to sort of ensure that, and this is kind of a long, drawn-out affair, if you go to that particular, assuming it's a group, there's a health information department.
I go to Carl's. So.
Okay. Well, there's a health information department that's basically the old medical records department. And you can formally request a copy of any or all parts of your medical record. The information contained in your record is yours.
Uh-huh, okay.
And there's absolutely no reason why you're not entitled to that. But the simplest thing, and many physicians do this, when you come in and you request a copy, for me personally, what I simply do when I'm dictating is I say, please send the patient a copy of this dictation, and they just mail it out.
That sounds good. When I've gotten them, I found them very helpful, but mostly I don't get them.
Well, and I think you're right, and I think the more people know about their medical situation, the better.
Well, exactly. That's how we try to be a good patient, but, you know, I can't remember everything that's said in an office visit.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I will, the Health Information Department.
Correct.
Thank you.
You're right. Well, thank you. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is also someone in Urbana, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I saw some information about calcium supplements, and I'm taking about 1,200 units, half in the morning, half in the evening. My bone density is slightly low, but I've not had any breaks or anything of the sort. I'm wondering if taking it, four times a day, same amount, would be more useful. I saw the suggestion that high intake at one time may not be as effective as a more dispersed intake.
In terms of separating it out, your likelihood of absorbing it better is probably higher instead of taking a large dose all at once. But it is at least relatively unusual for men to need a calcium supplement. You mentioned your bone mineral density was low. Why was it checked?
I've had some back problems. And actually, I'll be having surgery for a herniated disc in the near future. Okay. And they did a bone density scan.
And you're taking some supplemental vitamin D as well?
Yes.
Okay.
I think at the recommended dose level, I can't remember what that was.
If you're actually supplementing, you probably 1,000 international units a day.
I believe that's it.
Okay. And then some type of weight-bearing exercise?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, stretching exercises.
Walking?
I do a lot of walking and bicycling.
Okay. Unfortunately, the biking is good for your heart, probably doesn't do much for your bones, but the walking is actually one of the better things for the bones of your back and hips. So that's actually quite appropriate. The splitting up of the calcium is not an unreasonable thing. I'm assuming that you're not getting a lot of calcium in your diet?
Well, it seems to me I should be because I'm maybe a slightly fanatical gardener, and I certainly get broccoli and cabbage and such, and it stays in my diet pretty well. Okay.
Milk and dairy products?
Well, I have milk usually in my coffee, and my morning cereal, I would have probably a cup of milk.
Okay. Typically, in terms of trying to ensure an adequate calcium intake, we're usually looking at three dairy milk servings per day, or, as you point out, other foods are high in calcium as well. Some combination of intake in terms of our diet and a calcium supplement should, in fact, be adequate. You're usually trying to get somewhere between 1,500 and 1,800 milligrams of calcium in per day. Whether that's dietary or supplement, it's kind of up to you. But spreading it out through the course of the day will probably help ensure adequate absorption so that you get the benefit of it.
Yes. It is fairly unusual for men to need supplemental calcium, isn't it?
As a general rule, yes. Though men, as they get older, 75 and above, it becomes more common, but it's not nearly as common as it is in women who, as a result of the postmenopausal state, tend to develop osteoporosis much more commonly. There are some underlying medical situations that would promote the tendency toward osteoporosis. Sometimes people have a family history, and it's an inherited tendency. We know that smoking is associated with osteoporosis. If you have some other medical condition that has required, say, steroid treatment, that in and of itself can do it. Certain types of long-term seizure medications are associated with an increased risk for osteoporosis. So there are times when men, because of their other medical conditions, can in fact be at a little higher risk for osteoporosis.
Well, I am 75 and plus, and I have had steroid treatments for the herniated disc in the past, over about 5 years, 6 years.
And those would probably be contributory factors?
Yes. So I suppose the surgery should reduce the necessity of using the steroids. I think I've had them about four times.
Right. And ideally, if your surgery goes well, you're exactly right. That shouldn't require then any type of supplemental steroid medication afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just curious. Apparently there has been some theorizing hypotheses that supplemental use actually might, particularly if it's excessive, actually be counterproductive.
Well, certainly in individuals who've had any prior history of kidney stones, excessive calcium supplementation can very definitely be a problem because the vast majority of kidney stones are calcium-based. And in fact, that's one of the potential causes for kidney stones is simply people who are taking in too much. So in those particular situations, it can be problematic.
Would a bone density test in 3 or 4 years be in order?
That's probably a reasonable time frame. It generally is going to take at least 2 years to see a very noticeable or significant difference in bone density. That is something that changes very, very slowly. Oftentimes folks will come in and say, oh, well, I've been doing this for 6 months. Can we check it again? And the answer is, well, there's really not much point because it's not going to have changed statistically significantly enough to be able to tell any difference. So, yes, somewhere in the 3-year range would be perfectly reasonable.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're talking this morning in this Hour of Focus with Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl in Urbana. This is our Talk to the Family Doctor show. We do it every other month. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Joan Rivers. Her new book is I Hate Everyone, Starting with Me. I hate obituaries. Yeah, well, that don't tell you the truth.
So you read obituaries like every day. It's one of the first things.
Sure, because that's how I meet new men. The minute it says Sadie Schwartz.
Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have two different topics for you every morning. Tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, Sandy Mason will be here. She is an Extension horticulture educator with U of I Extension, and every month, always on a Tuesday, she's here. We talk about things that grow in the home landscape. Also tomorrow, the guest is Peter Stearns. He is a professor at George Mason University. We will talk about his book, Satisfaction Not Guaranteed, Dilemmas of Progress in Modern Society. Then Wednesday at 10, Political Corruption in Illinois will be our topic. We'll talk with David Morrison, Deputy Director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, and also Dick Simpson. He's Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Check the schedule by going to the website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can follow us on Twitter at Well Public Media. You can also find us on Facebook. In this hour of the show, our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. And every other month for a long time now, he's been with us regularly to do this show. We just call it Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that whatever's on your mind, you have a health care question, give us a call, and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk, so W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. I'm sure that we've talked from time to time about, just kind of picking up on what the last caller said, about generally about vitamin supplementation. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who are taking all kinds of things. And nutritionists, they will tell you they would prefer that you got your vitamins by eating healthy foods and having a good diet. But maybe if you can't, it might not hurt. But, though really, do you think that there's value in supplementing, particularly say if you're just doing a multiple vitamin mineral one a day kind of thing?
I think that's probably fine. It's the situation where people sort of go overboard with multiple supplements at particularly high doses. More recently, interestingly enough, in some population studies, they basically found that those folks actually had a higher death rate than folks who weren't taking multiple supplements at high doses. So the old philosophy of, oh, well, you know, it's over the counter. Mm-hmm. I can't be hurt by something that I take that's over the counter really isn't true. The vast majority of supplements that are marketed are truly untested in terms of their health benefits or potential risks. They certainly don't carry FDA approval for treatment of any particular disease. And if you ever sort of watch carefully on some of the commercials, the small print at the bottom of the screen says, you know, this substance has never been approved for diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. Mm-hmm. Yet they're allowed to advertise and make all sorts of claims. So it's one of those things where you basically, you know, buyer beware, I guess. Yeah. I'm not sure that anybody really needs, in the absence of a documented deficiency, any high-dose supplementation. Now, in specific individuals with specific medical conditions where a deficiency has been diagnosed, then it's quite appropriate to supplement that and treat it and get it back up into the normal range. Going beyond, you know, the typical American attitude is if one is good, then two must be better. but supplementing beyond the normal range may not turn out to be very healthy.
Well, there are, I guess, one reason one might be concerned is that I guess there are some vitamins that basically if you take a lot of them will just run through you and that there are others that can be stored in the body and you can actually build up toxic levels.
There are two basic types of vitamins, those that are water-soluble. Basically, those are the ones that you take, and if your body can't absorb it all, ends up going out through the urinary tract. So you are, in fact, letting your dollars stream away. The other ones are fat-soluble, and those, when taken in excess, are, in fact, stored in the body and, in some instances, can, in fact, reach toxic levels.
Yeah. And are there particular ones of those that you would just say, you know, watch out for?
Well, one commonly used supplemental vitamin is vitamin E, and there have been numerous studies that basically have found no benefit and, in fact, sometimes harm from using it. So I actually try to discourage people from overdoing that.
Okay. We have some more folks to talk with. First in line is number one, and that is someone in Champaign right here. Hello.
That's me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I heard the call about the immunization from for shingles, and when I had heard about that, I requested that I have that shot, and then before I had it, I read in one of my newsletters that there was a medicine that you might be taking that precluded the use of that medicine for preventing shingles. And I don't remember what it was, but I think it was methotrexate.
That's quite possible. There are, in fact, individuals with underlying medical conditions who are being treated with medications that in and of itself may lower their immunity. And the shingles vaccination is a live virus vaccine, so there is some concern in those individuals about giving it to them. As with all medications and immunizations, it needs to be reviewed with your personal physician to make sure that, in fact, it's appropriate. But you are quite correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And that would be something that, though, sometime, unless you were taking that medicine chronically, if sometime later, once you had not been on, you had stopped taking that, then it would be okay to get the
correct
shingles vaccine.
That's correct.
Okay. Are there other things that stand out as being contraindications for the shingles vaccine?
Probably those folks undergoing chemotherapy or somebody on high-dose steroids.
Okay. So now it sounds like it's generally probably more and more people, once they get to age 60, assuming that they are otherwise in good health, and there's no reason not to, it is recommended at that point, it probably would be a good idea for them to go ahead and get the shot.
That's correct.
Okay. Next, we have number two, and Charleston, I believe that is right. Line number two. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One involves if you don't get the vaccine. I had chickenpox when I was a child, and I'm in my 70s now. And the second question is, what part of the body is attacked by the shingles usually? Is there some like around the waistband or stress in one's life that gives rise to these?
The current thought is that anything that temporarily lowers your immunity, and the most common cause of lowered immunity is simply advancing age, that you basically no longer can suppress the activity of the virus in your body, and so that it basically erupts. The most common place to see the shingles rash is typically somewhere on the trunk, and it's usually on one half of the body. It generally is not going to be on both sides at the same time. But it literally can occur anywhere that you have a nerve in your body. So we've seen it in people's scalp, over their face, down the trunk, on the legs, arms. It can literally occur anywhere, but it seems to be the most common places is on the trunk. In terms of your exposure as a child, yes, you had the chicken pox. The virus is still in your system. If your immune system is competent, it's going to continue to suppress the activity of that virus, and we certainly hope that you never get shingles. If you want to maximize your chances of boosting your immune system specifically for that, then you get the shingles vaccination. But if you would have some stressful medical event, a major illness, an accident, surgery, sometimes just stressful life events, anything that temporarily alters your immunity may, in fact, make you a little bit more susceptible to having that virus reactivate.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go next to line number three, somebody in Champaign, I believe, right here. Hello.
Yes, I was listening to the elderly gentleman who asked about calcium and supplements and so forth. One thing I just wanted to note was on the People's Pharmacy the other night, this was 5 p.m. on Saturdays in the WILL, it's a show that's centered at the Duke University Medical School, and they were interviewing Harvard professors as well as a professor from an institute in Europe. I forget her name, but it was somebody famous. And one thing they noted was that their view is that as of the most recent evidence with regard to calcium is that there is a correlation, at least in the latest study in Europe, of 900 individuals with increased risk of heart attack. And so they were very, how should I say, they were not recommending taking supplements of calcium because of that finding. That, you know, just something to think about. One other thing I was, they also talked about was coffee, and I'm a coffee drinker, and I have polyps on my stomach. Now, they didn't talk about issues like that, but they did talk about coffee. And, you know, what's interesting about coffee is the latest findings are that it's very good for you, you know, and I've been quite pleasantly surprised by this. But I am a little bit concerned about polyps in my stomach. So, you know, I have seen my doctor previously who suggested that I shouldn't, you know, drink very much coffee and so forth. But there's no cancer that runs my family, stomach cancer and so forth. So I'm kind of not really worried about it at this point.
Well, coffee is one of those things that has sort of gone in and out of vogue as either being a villain or hero,
right.
Depending
yeah, exactly.
on when you listen. So, but you're correct. The more recent studies have suggested that it may actually be beneficial as opposed to harmful. I think one of those famous philosophers said, "Moderation in all things." And to the extent that somebody has, you know, a cup of coffee per day, that's probably not harmful. The guy who's going through two or three pots might
right.
be, you know, begging the question.
Yeah. The with regard to the calcium part of things, one thing they did note was that they noted the correlation. Interestingly, between countries with higher consumption of calcium, which is the West, and higher breaks in bones. And so they said that sort of shatters the evidence that it's necessarily good that you should be taking calcium supplements from that angle as well. So I just thought it was very, very interesting. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's, I guess that still it raises in my mind this difficulty of raising any sort of direct connection between any two things.
Well, it is, and there's also the discrepancy between information gained from population studies versus what happens in a given individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as our very, very first caller mentioned, you know, he gets a medicine and his buddy gets the same medicine. One gets a benefit, the other one gets a side effect. Is it the medicine? No, it's the differences in people. And it really comes down to each patient, each physician needs to carefully look at that person's unique set of medical circumstances and try to plot a path that maximizes the benefits and minimizes the risks with no absolute guarantees being promised.
Okay. Line one is our next caller. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have an kind of an unusual situation. I think I'm in my male in my 80s, and one breast has been kind of hurting me on and off. I don't know what in the world, whether I bumped it or something. I don't know. There's no feeling of any bruises or anything, but it just kind of stays with me, and I can even feel like the T-shirt over it. I can feel that with the breast. Do you have any thoughts about that?
How long have you been aware of it?
It's about a week.
Okay. Is there a lump or a bump associated with it?
There is not. No, no feeling of anything like that.
Okay. And you don't visibly see any swelling, redness?
No. No. Okay. It's just kind of a mild hurting, kind of goes a little lighter and then a little more so and then on and off.
Okay. Did it follow any specific physical activity? Were you doing something particularly vigorous in terms of lifting?
No. No. Not that I can recall, certainly. Okay. I don't think so.
The reason we were asking is that the underlying muscles of the chest wall can, in fact, be sore due to just physical activity. If it happens to be the pectoral muscle underneath the breast, then that's the area that's going to be sore.
Well, I do go to the fitness center once a week, but I don't recall anything like that or anything. I've always exercised a little bit. I don't know. Strange.
And life is certainly full of strange things. To the extent that it's only been present for a very short time, and there's no visible abnormality and no lump or bump that you can feel, you know, comparing it to the other side, you haven't identified anything that sounds particularly worrisome, though obviously anything that persists or evolves needs to be checked out. But the things that we would normally be concerned about would be a lump or a bump or some type of visible inflammation or swelling.
Right. Okay. Well, that's fine.
All right. Well, hope that helps. We're coming down to our last couple of minutes. We'll try to get the callers. We have two. We'll try to get them in. And we'll go next to line two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I am. I had last year I experienced kidney failure, and so I'm on dialysis. But I had a question preceding my discovering this renal failure. I had a terrible, terrible bout of psoriasis, and I just wanted to ask Dr. Swearinger, what the connection might be between that and the and renal failure.
Let's see here. I'm trying to think of whether or not any of the medications that might have been prescribed for psoriasis were systemic.
No. Oh, pardon?
Were you on some type of systemic medication?
No, I didn't. I just elected not to do that. I suffered awfully, but I didn't want to take any kind of steroid and that was about all they prescribed. I took some oh my God, I don't remember the name of it. It starts with a C, but it's an oil, a calendula oil. And actually, that was as helpful as any steroid, and I felt like it wasn't as dangerous.
And that was something topical?
Yes.
Okay.
I took it topically. But when I had the kidney failure, it pretty much cleared up. And I think that for one thing, they put me on massive doses of vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, but I think that might have, had a huge effect on it.
And certain variations of vitamin D have been used for treatment of psoriasis. So,
and this was vitamin
D3. Yeah. So there's definitely some potential relationship between the use of the vitamin D and the improvement in the psoriasis. But in some instances, people have other medical conditions associated with the skin findings of psoriasis. But I personally haven't seen kidney failure before, so I'm not sure that I can necessarily connect those two.
Okay, it might they might not have been related so much then, huh?
I don't have any information right now that would lead me to connect those two.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll try real quick here to get another caller here, line number two, or pardon me, three. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes?
I was wondering about vitamins K and K1. I've heard they're good for arteries, keeping your arteries flexible.
In terms of supplementation?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any particular studies that have concluded that people need supplemental vitamin K in order to keep their arteries flexible.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, that'll give us time to hear if I can. Real quick, we have someone who was listening to the conversation about shingles and said they have a 19-year-old son who just was diagnosed with shingles, mm-hmm. Saying that he has had no traumatic events lately, medical or otherwise, and that the person who's writing believes that he, in fact, did have chickenpox when he was a child. And it's just curious about what could have triggered it, and I guess perhaps also the question is, well, is it really how unusual is it for someone who is 19 to have shingles?
Most kids this age have been immunized for chickenpox, but there was a group that only got a single vaccination. It was not thought to be as effective, and the younger kids these days are getting two chickenpox immunizations to help minimize the chance of that. So I would probably go back and look and see if that was an individual who only got one and may not have been fully immunized. Mm. And there are times when we simply don't have a good explanation for why somebody came out with shingles. It can, in fact, occur at any age. It's just that it's not as common statistically in younger folks.
And if you've already had shingles, is there a reason to have the vaccine?
Yes, because you can have shingles again.
All right. We've got to leave it there with our thanks for many, many hours of service here to the program. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it. Your kind attention.
Thank you very much. Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana.